One of the difficulties that we face here is that we're really trying to do something that humans have not done before, which is act in a concerted effort on a global scale over a decadal time frames to address a global problem. Human beings haven't really worked together that way before, but that's one of the things that we're asking them to do here, and unfortunately that takes time. But time is not on our side, and time is one of the critical issues facing this conference.
Welcome to the 2 Degrees Show, the UK's weekly show dedicated to climate change. We're halfway through the UN climate talks in Nairobi, and our mission today is to offer you an assessment of where things are at. We'll be doing that by presenting what the Alliance of Environmental Charities and the UN Secretariat have been saying in their press conferences over the last few days. The two main spokespeople you'll hear are Steve Sawyer, who you heard at the top of the programme, and who works for Greenpeace in the United States, and is also the main spokesman for the Climate Action Network, the umbrella group for hundreds of non-governmental organisations who are trying to positively influence the talks. The other is Ivo de Boer, head of the UN Climate Change Secretariat. The current Kyoto Protocol has been described as a drop in the bucket. It's simply not ambitious enough to prevent dangerous climate change, which is the ultimate objective of these talks. Worse still, the United States and Australia are currently standing outside the Kyoto Protocol. As Steve Sawyer from Greenpeace said at the top of the show, the clock is ticking and time is running out. What the environmental charities represented by the Climate Action Network are looking for out of these talks sounds simple enough. It is a clear timetable and process for undertaking the review of the Kyoto Protocol so that it finishes by 2008 and is in place when the second commitment period starts in 2012. Here's what Ivo de Boer had to say about that.
The climate change process is a science-based, science-driven process. So basically it was the alarm bell from science that at COP1 moved politicians to begin negotiating the Kyoto Protocol. What you see at the moment are a lot of scientific and economic signals that tell us we are going to be confronted with severe consequences of climate change, and that current policies in place, the Kyoto Protocol, is insufficient to deal with the long-term problem of climate change. So everyone is basically in agreement that we need to move forward. Everyone is basically in agreement that we should not allow a gap to fall between the Kyoto Protocol and what happens after 2012. The concern that is on people's mind is, when is that process of negotiating the future going to begin in a formal way? At the moment we have the ad hoc working group, which is looking at future targets, future commitments for industrialized countries. We have the dialogue, which is looking at future climate change policy in a much broader way, but we do not have in place at the moment a formal mandate to begin negotiating the long-term future. And that is really the essence there is, when is that mandate going to be given? What will be the basis for that mandate? And what will be the conditions under which a forward-looking negotiating process is launched? To give you, for example, when the Kyoto Protocol was negotiated, a very clear guiding principle was that it should contain no new commitments for developing countries, and that it should respect the concept of common but differentiated responsibilities. Now, these are the kinds of issues that people are concerned about in terms of a future mandate.
Article 9 of the Kyoto Protocol specifies that these climate talks shall undertake periodic reviews of the protocol in the light of the best available scientific information. Such a review has to start at this meeting. The African group, though, is arguing that the first review be without substance and that a subsequent review is held in 2 or 3 years' time. What seems to be worrying developing countries is that Australia, Canada, Japan and the US have been arguing that developing countries should start taking on binding emissions cuts. Poor countries also want to see developed countries living up to their existing commitments under the Kyoto Protocol. Alan Tate of EBA Australia put the following question to Ivo de Boer.
Alan Tate, EBA Australia. On leaving for Nairobi, Australia's ministerial head of delegation said on the weekend that he will be arriving in Nairobi to push for a new Kyoto involving all of the world's major emitters, and that the problem with the current Kyoto Protocol is that it does not ask China and India to do a single thing to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. As much as you're able to, from your perspective, could I ask you to comment on that?
Both the Climate Change Convention and the Kyoto Protocol contain a significant number of commitments for developing countries. Both the Climate Change Convention and the Kyoto Protocol call on developing countries to undertake programs and measures to reduce their emissions of to limit their emissions of greenhouse gases, to take action in the field of transportation, and developing countries also have a number of responsibilities in terms of reporting. So it would be incorrect to say that developing countries currently have no commitments, no obligations under the Kyoto Protocol. Important, however, is that the action on the part of developing countries, as set down in the Kyoto Protocol, is conditional on international resources being provided, international resources that actually make it possible for developing countries to act. And one of the big complaints that developing countries have is that in their perception, those resources haven't been provided to the extent they feel is necessary. And one of the concerns that you sometimes hear is that they might be called upon to take even farther-reaching action while some of the current financial commitments have not been made. But so that was a very long answer to your question. The short answer is developing countries already have obligations and commitments, and developing countries already are fully part of the climate change process, but in accordance with their means.
As Greenpeace's Steve Sawyer pointed out, if industrialised country emissions dropped to zero by 2050, even that wouldn't be sufficient to avoid dangerous climate change. Certain developing countries will need to play their part. He outlined quite a nuanced position of what role developing countries need to play, depending on the circumstances of the country concerned.
The reality is that if we are going to avoid dangerous climate change, that we need emissions reductions of at least 50% on 1990 levels by the middle of the century. And if all of the Annex I countries' emissions went to zero by the middle of this century, then that still wouldn't be low enough. When you talk about the non-Annex I countries or the developing countries, you have a very, very, very diverse group of countries. First of all, they're the least developed country group, small island states, relatively undeveloped countries economically, and there's no question that they should take on emissions reductions obligations. They don't even measure on the scale. And what they will need is assistance from the rich countries to adapt to the climate changes. Sub-Saharan Africa, Andean South America, South Asia, parts of Southeast Asia, and certainly in many, if not most, small island developing states. Then at the other end of the scale of the non-Annex I countries, there is a group of countries who are in non-Annex I largely through political deal that was cut in 1992, which may or may not have been a good judgment of things in 1992, but it's certainly ridiculous today. There's a number of countries whose per capita incomes and whatever are as high or higher than the European average, or indeed the OECD average, which are considered developing countries. And I'm thinking here of South Korea, Singapore, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Qatar, Oman. You know, they're wealthier countries than many European Union countries. So there's one set of problems to deal with. Perhaps the obvious answer is yes, they should join Annex B and have legally binding emissions reductions obligations. The most important group from a climate mitigation point of view and from the point of view of large country economies, of course, is Brazil, India, China, and South Africa. And Indonesia, if you want to include deforestation emissions. Now, you can say they're a group, but they're actually very, very diverse economies with a very different range. I mean, India's per capita emissions are so low, and their GDP per capita is so low, that if the whole world was consuming at the same level as India, there would be no climate change convention because we wouldn't have a problem. So for rich countries to blame India and China for the climate change problem is immoral and disingenuous at best. China, their per capita income is about double that of India, but it's still 1/6 or 1/7 of the OECD average. So these two very large countries, which because of the size of their populations and the size of their economies, do emit a lot of greenhouse gases, and those are projected to rise in the future, still have a long way to go in economic development terms before they can satisfy the legitimate needs of their people for a decent quality of life. And what we need to figure out is how this process and this convention can help them achieve that level of economic growth with the lowest possible increase in carbon dioxide emissions in the short term, and how to actually decrease that over time. And the responsibility for paying for those incremental costs for doing that clearly must lie with the industrialized countries. Brazil and South Africa are two very different economies, but they're roughly twice again as rich per capita as China, for instance, and a little bit more. Very diverse economies and lots of inequities within the countries, but they have probably a higher obligation to act than China and India, and they're willing to do so. I mean, the interesting thing is that all of these countries have fairly aggressive national programs to reduce their emissions, to clean up their air, to decarbonize their economies, and they are decarbonizing, but they're also growing at an enormous rate. So figuring out the financial and technological mechanisms through which this convention can actually interact in a much broader way with those economies to bring about a reduction in absolute emissions from those large economies over the next couple of decades, that's the biggest challenge that we face here. And at the moment, they're saying, you know, you're rich countries, it's your obligation to reduce. We're poor countries, and we don't have any obligations. And on the other hand, you have some of the rich countries saying, oh, climate change, it's all your fault. Those are equally ridiculous postures that must be overcome before we get to the real conversation about what needs to be done to get us to those emissions reductions targets over the next 45 years, which is where we need to be. It's a rather complicated subject, but I mean, those are some of the basic issues that we need to get to seriously grapple with. And we won't resolve any of those here. We just need to figure out a way to have that conversation in a constructive fashion so that we can come to next year's COP and agree to fight it out over what the answers are going to be for the second commitment period. But should those large industrialized countries have binding emissions reductions obligations for the second commitment period? Clearly not. But they need to have mechanisms in place to help decarbonize their economies, and whether they have legally binding emissions reductions obligations in the third commitment period, I think you'd get a different answer for each one of those four big countries.
Climate Action Network have been arguing that it is in developing countries' interest not to block the review of the Kyoto Protocol. They argue that a review could lever in the adaptation funding that the very poorest countries, who will be hit the hardest by climate change, desperately need. The United Nations Development Programme's annual report says that current support for adaptation in developing countries is, quote, woefully inadequate, unquote, amounting to a pitiful $20 million a year annually. This is Erasmus from Friends of the Earth Ghana speaking at the Climate Action Network press briefing on Monday.
A United Nations report issued on November 5th, 2006, says that the African continent is vulnerable to the impacts of climate change than earlier feared. Agriculture accounts for over 40% of total export earnings for sub-Saharan Africa, and also accounts for 60 to 90% of the total labor force. About 50% of total household earnings comes from agriculture. With this as the background and the current impacts on of climate change on agriculture sector, African continent is very, very vulnerable to the impacts of climate change. And that we calling on the international community and vulnerable country delegates here to push for adaptation mechanisms that addresses the needs of adaptation. Some impacts caused by emissions of greenhouse gases on the African continent cannot be addressed in the next 30 years despite global attempts to reduce emissions. This makes adaptation needs very, very critical for the African continent. Climate Action Network and Friends of the Earth is calling on vulnerable country delegates to push for mechanisms that addresses adaptation needs in the convention. I draw attention particularly to the review of Article 9, that the review of Article 9 process allows flexible mechanisms which pushes for the addressing adaptation needs. It will be immoral on the part of G77 group, African delegates and delegates from least development countries not to push for strong review of Article 9. It is their moral right to seek for compensation under the convention. And therefore, we're calling on them to make their voices very vocal. Wake up, African delegates. You have your say in these negotiations, and the future of adaptation needs of the African continent lies solely in your hands. Push for these adaptation needs. Thank you.
Climate Action Network strongly attacked the EU at the start of the second week of the UN climate talks for their lack of leadership. They want to see the EU lead the way by adopting a firm, common commitment to reduce their carbon dioxide emissions by 30% by 2020. They argue that if the EU is not leading, then who is? Cannes is also concerned that the EU has been talking about an open-ended review of the Kyoto Protocol, rather than one which has a fixed timetable and is therefore guaranteed to be in place when the second commitment period starts. Conference Secretary Ivo de Boer offered another view on why the European Union might be arguing for an open-ended review rather than one with a fixed deadline.
My sense is that the European Union is putting a lot of emphasis on and a lot of effort into trying to reach agreement on some of these issues that are crucial to developing countries. And my impression is that the European Union is not pushing for a conclusion on a future mandate. So in that sense, they're perhaps showing good leadership rather than bad leadership.
The Guardian reported that, quote, British and other diplomats are pressing for rich countries to agree a new UN fund worth hundreds of millions of pounds to be financed by a levy on the burgeoning global trade in carbon emissions, unquote. The BBC added that a disagreement had arisen over who should manage such a fund. Western nations want control to lie with the Global Environment Facility, a body based in the US and closely tied to the World Bank, whose record in this area is highly dubious, to say the least. Developing countries, meanwhile, argue that they should have more control over how these funds are managed. But is the EU putting the timing of the review in jeopardy, as the Climate Action Network alleges? When asked about the importance of a fixed end date for the first review of the Kyoto Protocol, Ivo de Boer gave two conflicting views about this. A journalist from the Spanish news agency put the following questions to the conference secretary.
Isabel Goya from the Spanish news agency. In order to avoid this gap between the first period of commitments and the second, and considering that Kyoto took 2 years to negotiate and a post-Kyoto could even take longer because more countries could be joining Annex 1 or more reductions, I mean more ambitious reductions could be in discussion, do you think this formal mandate should be launched in Nairobi in order to achieve in time the deadlines so that countries can ratify the new deal so that, you know, you avoid that gap that everybody's talking about?
I do not think that formal mandate to begin discussing the future should be given here. I think it's too early to give that formal mandate. The ad hoc working group and the dialogue, which will be holding meetings for several years, were exactly intended to begin exploring the future in an informal way. So I think that those two processes should be given the time they need. And secondly, I think that this COP, by delivering on a number of issues that are important to developing countries, can help to build the confidence that is essential to begin talking about the future. So I would say that this conference of parties is too early to provide a formal negotiating mandate. Having said that, you'll probably now stand up and ask me which conference of parties is too late to provide the formal negotiating mandate. And that would be a question I can't answer very precisely. But if I calculate back the way that you were just doing, then everyone wants to avoid a gap between 2012 and beyond. It took us 2 years to get the Kyoto Protocol ratified, so that takes us back to 2010. It took us 2 years to negotiate the Kyoto Protocol, so that would take us back to 2008. But then, as you say, things are slightly more complicated than they are now than they were then, so maybe 2008 to 2010 is not enough, and you might want to go back to 2007. So that's somewhere around that period.
Another possible explanation for EU dithering is that it's waiting for the US to come back on board. Steve Sawyer of Greenpeace gave an assessment of the effect of the recent swing to the Democrats in the US. As a result of the congressional elections, would we now see legislation coming forward in the US that forces them to re-engage with the Kyoto process? Or does the world have to hold out for a new president in 2008?
Thank you. My name is Jakob Meyer from German Radio. Could you tell us something about your concerns and hopes after the shifts in majority in the US Congress to bring them back in the boat sometime?
Certainly a political tsunami is sweeping across the United States. The pendulum has swung and it's moving back in the right direction. But it was so far to the right and so far in the wrong direction, it's going to take a long time before the United States gets back into a position where it can take leadership in this process. We believe that day is coming, but it's going to be a long time. 3-4 years at least. We hear a lot of talk, and this is maybe the source of some of the waffling from within the EU, that we want to wait for the United States. Well, waiting for the United States basically means that you put off the second commitment period Kyoto negotiations to the point where they don't mean much anymore. the Congress will try to do some good things in the next 2 years. We will be supporting them. We hope that they'll be dogging the U.S. negotiators in this process. But they're not going to get a good piece of legislation through the U.S. Congress while George Bush is still president. And unfortunately, until and unless he has an affair with an intern, he's going to be president through January 20th or thereabouts in 2009. So that's when the new president comes in, hopefully with a stronger majority in the U.S. Congress, and that's when the serious work on building a U.S. national cap-and-trade system will begin at a federal level. I mean, we've seen wonderful advances with the landmark legislation in California. That's being talked about being linked to other states, both on the West Coast and certainly the New England and Northeast regional agreement to limit greenhouse gases. The mini Kyoto in the northeastern part of the United States is gathering steam, but you know, miracles happen, but it seems unlikely in the extreme that good legislation is going to pass through the U.S. Congress, which George Bush is not going to veto. So we're waiting until the new president gets in office. Whenever a new president gets into office, it takes them 6 months just to hire the people to get them in place so that they can build a partnership with the new Congress to get cap-and-trade legislation. Secondly, the U.S. is not going to negotiate that with the rest of the world. The basis for the U.S. reentry into Kyoto will be, we believe, on the basis of its own national cap-and-trade system, calling for emissions reductions, which will be then linked to the existing Kyoto mechanisms and trading system, and that will be the mechanism back in for the U.S. There's a strong consensus built around that about all of the people who have looked at this question. And then in the subsequent commitment periods, the U.S. can rejoin the negotiations. But if we wait for that, which is end of 2009 at the earliest and much more likely sometime in 2010, then the point that I outlined it up front about avoiding a gap between the first and commitment period, it's impossible. We cannot wait for the U.S. or the Kyoto Protocol in its current form will die. Many people would like that, but we don't believe that the European Union and the other progressive countries, and certainly the large countries in the G77, do not want that to die. We've invested so much and we've built it so far that waiting around for the U.S. will basically mean the end. And who knows where they might end up anyway. I mean, we see a very clear trend in the United States right now, and we believe it will continue for a long time, but we can't assure that. And the rest of the world needs to move ahead.
That was Steve Sawyer from Greenpeace. The UN talks continue this week, with draft decisions coming out of the various sub-bodies, and ministers start arriving for the high-level segment and the open-ended dialogue on future action. Nicholas Stern is also due to make a presentation on his report on the economics of climate change. Next week, we'll be getting some expert analysis on how the talks turned out. In the meantime, you can follow the progress of the talks on the UN website at www.unfccc.int, and also the Climate Action Network and its daily eco bulletin, which you can find at www.climatenetwork.org. And if you want to hear this show again, it will be archived shortly at CoinNet. That's coinet.org.uk/climateradio.